Once again, here's James McKenney. And James, this is part of the show where we turn it over to the audience. Who knows where they'll take it, but all over the place. Listen, do you want to promote your books?
Sure.
Do it.
And by the way, I remember the name of that volcano. It's Tambora.
Thank you.
1800s blew up and caused a mini ice age.
Mm.
The website, of course, is linked from the Coast to Coast web page.
Naturally.
And that's the best way to get to my site, so you get to the correct location. And
yeah, but there's people like out on the road and stuff like that, and they might go there after the link. So that said, if they wanted to get to you and they went to Google and wanted to have you come up, what would they put in?
Put J.M. McKenney, McCanney.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the top one that comes up, and all those misinformation sites of bad-mouthing me come up right underneath me. So pick the top one. That'll
all
be
right.
My
so
website.
You mean there's actually sites that bad-mouth you?
Oh, yes.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. But it's www.jmccanneyscience.com. That's the website. And I always have a little special for the coast-to-coast audience. For people who like to use mail order. And tonight, the book we're talking about is Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, and that's kind of a long title, but it's written for the general public, so you understand how our solar system weather works and how it affects us on Earth. And that book typically retails for $35, but tonight, for the audience, that'd be $25. And that includes shipping and handling.
Boy, you really love them.
And so the address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's $25 to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. And just ask for the weather book, and we'll know what you're talking about there.
You ever sign them?
They go out from a place where I don't see them actually.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go to a talk like I did recently, then I sign them. But,
that's nice. All right. So somebody could find you and present you with your book, and you would then sign it.
Oh, absolutely. I've signed many of them. Just that when things come in through either the web page or unfortunately, I have had to step out of the process of that just to so that I could direct my attention to my research, etc.
Got it. All right, here they come. International Line, you're on the air with James McKenney. Where are you, please?
Hi, my name is Mick. I'm in Winnipeg, Canada.
All right, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Art. My question is for your guest, James.
Hello.
Hi, James. Earlier in the show, you were talking about NASA importing a massive drill bit to supposedly drill out a bunker to protect them in case a comet hit.
He's talking about the drill bit.
The drill bit for tunnel drilling, and they put a big rotary machine behind this, and they just tunnel through the ground. So they make long tunnels, and this one was an extra large one.
Okay, I understand that. And that reminded me of a movie I saw called Armageddon. Where a comet was coming, and they had this idea of sending these guys out to drill big holes in the meteor and then, like, put some nukes in there and blow it up. And I was just wondering,
yes,
is that even possible, like, if they had a big enough spaceship to get that bit out there?
That really is a cool question. Is that kind of thing they depicted there with the size of the rock that they were trying to affect? Was that realistic from a physics point of view?
The problem is now you've got many pieces. So the question is, do you want to be hit by a bigger bullet or a shotgun?
Well, as I recall, they split it in two, and both sides went on each side of Earth and neatly missed us. Is
uh-huh.
that the not a likely outcome?
Well, the problem with drilling in outer space is that there's nothing to grab onto. When we drill on Earth, you have gravity and you can drill, but the drilling in outer space is posed a problem because there's no relatively zero gravity on these objects.
Well, we if something was headed our way, we would try something.
Well, might think so. Well, my own solution for this is that understanding that comets' orbits are diverted by their tail drag. You could extend a tether out from an object like this in advance. You'd have to be...
A tether,
which is a self-reeling device. Once you get it going, it just will reel out away from the sun.
What an interesting idea.
You discharge the local solar capacitor. The material comes in. It changes the orbit of the object, and without any explosions or whatever, you better make sure you know this is going to hit Earth, and then you spirit it away, and it misses Earth because you've changed its orbit due to the tail drag. But the physical thing you do is attach a tether to it and let it reel out away from the sun.
So therein lies the tail.
And you induce the tail, the discharge of the solar capacitor, which then creates the tail, which is drawn in and ultimately changes the orbit.
Got it. First time caller line, your turn with James McKenney. Hello.
Is this wild card line?
First time caller line, sir.
Oh, am I on?
Are you not a first time caller?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought I called the wild card line.
No,
yeah.
You called the first time caller line. You are a first time caller, right?
Okay,
Are you a first time caller?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
My name is Ken, and I'm calling from Florida.
Yes.
And I've got a question for Mr. McKenney.
Yes.
Yes.
James, how are you doing?
Oh, good, Ken. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not a scientist, but I have a lot of common sense, more than I would say the average person. And what you was talking about, that lake, draining that lake for the Yellowstone Park, I forget the name of the lake.
Yellowstone Lake?
Okay.
Yes.
Wouldn't that lake present a lot of pressure on that bulge on the bottom, the water itself?
Ah.
Well, that's...
In other words, he's saying that might be keeping the bulge from going kaboom.
Right. And not only that, it might be...
Well, cooling. Wait a minute. That's a good one. Stop right there while you're ahead. What about that, James?
Well, that's a good question. I don't believe the lake is very deep, but certainly...
Water is heavy.
Yeah. The question is, if you know, could you induce the bulge to grow more by taking the water out? Well, there again, you'd have to look at the
like maybe
engineering of this.
Cause it to blow sooner if you took the water.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, that's the kind of thing I always thought, like on Star Trek, instead of having a commander that made all the decisions, sometimes the guy... that maybe is closer to the action or whatever would have the best idea. So we have to, that's great to have input like this because...
Very good, caller. You've saved us.
And also the temperature. The water, wouldn't that have a cooling effect on the molten rock that's pushing up?
Another good point.
Right. Well, there again, but it's going in the wrong direction. And in both of these cases, if the water is there when this thing breaks, we're in big trouble.
Why? But if we cause it to break sooner, there would be less water to
and
make...
Plus, everybody would be angry with USGS or whoever did it.
Or Jim McKenney.
I was thinking I would hate to be you and make that decision of bumping the lake out and have it blow.
I'm glad you have that input because whenever you mess with nature, as we were saying before...
Yes.
There are side effects, and this could be one of them. So there might be a good call.
It didn't sound like a good call at the beginning, but it obviously was. Wildcard line, you're on the air with James McKenney. Hello.
Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning.
James.
Hello.
When one of these objects comes floating through, if it's sufficiently large to cause trouble, it would also be sufficiently large to, through some associated side effects, pick up a few rocks from the asteroid belt and also add to the shotgun effect, would it not?
Oh, they absolutely do, and that's part of the comet phenomenon is the what we call the meteor stream associated with comets. And the ancients talk about this, the hail of brimstone and fire. The brimstone was the meteor streams that came in along with the oil from the comet tail, the hydrocarbons. So absolutely, it's going to be picking these up, and there's an actual physical process by which comets cause the metallic structure in, like, small rocks and pebbles to be attracted. It's called the induced electric dipole force. But absolutely. And how big an object they would pick up depends on how big the comet is. But absolutely.
So the side effect could be in itself rather horrendous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are fields of rocks. They don't know where they came from over in the Mideast. That are, they call them rock fields. And they're literally entire vast regions of the desert that are just covered in rocks, and they have no idea where these come from. But the speculation is they come from outer space. There's a series of elliptical lakes. They're small lakes down in South Carolina, and the same thing. It appears that a big barrage of objects from outer space came in and dug these out, but there again, all we see now is the result. So obviously these things have happened in the past, and now that Schumacher Levy 9, the 21 pieces, hit Jupiter, scientists have become acutely aware of these objects coming and having multiple pieces coming in at one time.
Is Jupiter our protector in that regard? In other words, it's got so much yank to it that anything of substance it would likely get us would instead be captured and eaten by Jupiter?
Yes, in a sense, that's very true. But then again, like with the Venus event, it captured something that eventually ended up where we are. So it can work both ways.
Yeah, I suppose, for example, something could also only hit the outer part of Jupiter's influence and then be thrown toward us by that.
Right.
It's like a giant billiard table, isn't it?
That's what it is. It's a giant billiard game out there, and we're just... we're in a nice, stable orbit, but we're the target.
Uh-huh. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Hello.
Hi, this is Jean from Michigan.
Yes.
Hello, Jean.
I have a couple quick questions. One of them is, have we ever got a manned vehicle through the Van Allen radiation belt? Do you know?
Well, I don't personally know. I have my doubts.
Right.
But that's a problem. It's a very serious problem, and NASA's one of their major two programs. They have two programs that are cover-all programs within NASA. One is called Living with a Star, and that program, the other one is called Sun-Earth Connection, but the Living with the Star program is to learn how to deal with space radiation. And one of their, they have hundreds of scientists right now trying to figure out how to safely maneuver through the Earth, near-Earth radiation belts, which are the Van Allen belts. So that is a huge ongoing issue, and a lot of people are working on it. But to answer your question, I can't personally say yes or no to that.
Wow.
Right.
All right.
The other quick question I wanted to know is, what would that radiation belt perhaps help protect us if something came at us?
Well, no, it wouldn't deflect anything particularly in that sense. And if an object were coming to us, for example, it's extremely low density out there. The thing with the radiation belts is the speed of these particles. They're at relativistic speeds. They're zipping around out there, trapped in our magnetic field, and they're moving at extreme high velocity. So when they hit a metal spacecraft, that turns into an X-ray, and therein lies the radiation problem.
Mm-hmm. So big that you think we might not have done it?
Well, there is some problems. When NASA went to the moon, the Apollo program in the late 60s, early 70s, the only radiation they were aware of at the time were alpha and beta particles, which are actual particles that might hit somebody in their detectors, their badges that they wore. Actually, that NASA symbol on their chest was also a radiation detector. They had no X-ray detection of any kind at the time. And there's an example of when they first had the shuttle, they brought it up to about a 500-mile orbit, and the astronauts' eyes began to glow, or their eyelids, their eyebrows began to fluoresce, etc., and so they brought them back down very quickly.
Really?
And they never went up that far again.
Fluorescing eyebrows is very concerning.
Yeah, and the shuttle itself was fluorescing. They call it, the term is shuttle glow. So in the very early trips up there, they experienced what they call shuttle glow, which is actually is an electrical discharge.
Well, as an astronaut, I'd probably be willing to put up with the shuttle glowing, but I would draw the line at my eyebrows.
Eyebrows glowing.
Yeah,
and you can
absolutely.
Read the guy's book next to you with your eyebrows glowing.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanny. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona. I also have two questions, if possible.
Well, we'll see.
Dr. McCanny, you said earlier comets can cause surface fusion on the sun. So through the solar capacitor function in comet Tempel-1's impact, could it have been an electrical short caused, thus the sun displaying an increase in solar flare activity and or a measurable change in the heliosphere that could be responsible for our strange weather happenings on the continental U.S. with hurricanes and tornadoes?
No, you're talking about Tempel-1, the deep impact probe hitting the comet. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Oh, okay. Any events like that, in fact, we did see a bright flash, a secondary flash, after the probe hit comet Tempel-1 nucleus. The plume of material came out, and then there was an incredible flash, and that was an electrical discharge that attached to that material as it came out. But it's so far away from the sun that any of that would have been contained within the local plasma environment of the comet nucleus. So, no, I wouldn't associate that with...
All right, we're almost out of time. Caller, second question fast.
Well, Richard Hogan is working on the release of post-comet Tempel-1 information. He said last year would make your hair stand on end and that the imaging absence from the deep impact spacecraft is not due to equipment malfunction. You have any comment on that?
Oh, I was on the night with Richard July 4th when we were waiting for that data to come in, and we agreed on the air that there's something very hokey going on with the data. But absolutely, there's something missing there completely. But the photographs and the video, the series of clips, they made it into an actual video, makes it clear that that this is not a snowball. A lot of other things happened there. The spectrometer data we were talking about earlier clearly shows this is a hot, dry rock with no water. It's not producing anything that would form a comet tail, sublimating water of any kind. There's no. You have to understand, when you look at one of these comet nuclei, when the artist drew the artist conception earlier in the NASA program, expecting they expected this to look like a steam locomotive belching out water and et cetera, to form the comet tail. Nothing of the sort was found.
All right, hold it right there. Once again, James McCanny. Welcome back, James. Been a wild show, huh?
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of territory,
you
Art.
Sure have. First time caller line, your turn to cover some territory with James. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, this is Roy, currently in San Antonio. Thank you, Art. And the first time I've had my radio shut off to Art Bell is now because you requested me to. And James, what I was hoping to ask was, there's rumors that are saying that NASA has been going to the Hopi Indians, asking them what the heck is going on with the weather changes. Are you able to verify or confirm that?
That's true.
Is that true, Art?
Well, no. I'm not saying it is true that it's done. It's true that the rumors are out there big time.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I cannot confirm it myself, but if, here's the thing with this kind of information. In public, they would never admit that, but that's the real source of information. Those people lived through it. They have handed this information down, and they're the best source of information on what's really going on.
One more question, if I may.
Go ahead.
There's also a rumor in 99 the Earth took a 3-degree tilt on its axis.
You'd think we'd know about that one.
That I can tell you personally, it did not.
It did not. Okay.
I'm an astronomer myself, and there are so many rumors that the moon is not where it's supposed to be, and that the Earth is... you know, out of its orbit, et cetera. No, we're very much where we're supposed to be within any margin of error. There's small changes that go on all the time, some of which we don't totally understand, like the Chandler wobble or things like that. But no, we're where we're at. And
You brought up Chandler wobble. Can you tell me anything about that? Is it true that it has somewhat mysteriously stopped wobbling?
Well, it changes, and it's known to change. And the cause of the wobble itself is unknown. Some people believe it's due to the sloshing of the oceans in the cavities.
And occasionally even stops for a while. Is that correct?
Yes. And there's not a lot of exact data on this. It's like any geological phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
We may only have 100 years of data, and not all of that is the greatest.
Well, that's a good point.
So where it's going and where it's been... But there again, I don't see a lot of good current data on that myself. In fact, I've looked around for that, and it's one of those topics that there are probably some astronomers that have real good data, but I haven't personally seen it myself.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with James McKinney. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, my name is Jeff, and I'm from Orlando.
Yes, Jeff.
And one thing that I would have to ask James is when these large cometary bodies come by Earth, you know, he was saying that they don't necessarily hit, and I believe that entirely. The probability is that they don't hit. But when they do come by, is that one of the factors that changes the polarity in the Earth?
Uh-huh.
You mean like the magnetic polarity?
Well, it could either be a magnetic shift or... something worse, but his question is a good one. Could it precipitate such a thing?
Oh, absolutely. And when the Earth, the way
I'm asking,
the Earth is structured, we have the magnetic, what we call the magnetic North Pole, which is somewhat loosely coupled with the Earth, but the crust and mantle of the Earth ride over a viscous layer, which has actually been measured, it's not hypothetical, and then beneath that is the core. And this surface can slide over the lower layers, and that actually happens a lot of times during major earthquakes and plate shifting, etc. But the bottom line is you have a large object coming by, it sets up a gravitational wave, which then can shift this whole surface kind of shell over the core, and then it redistributes. During this process, the core continues to spin at the same rate and direction that it was spinning before. So, and all of this then kind of locks back together after the event. And it's very clear that our old North Pole used to be somewhere in the state of Ontario. That's why the magnetic North Pole is trying to migrate up to where the real North Pole is right now. So this really takes Earth takes a very good jarring. And so to answer your question, both the magnetic pole and the celestial pole, which is the rotational pole, can change dramatically during one of these events.
All right. So that was a yes.
Yes.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKinney.
Good morning. Is that me?
That's you.
Okay. I never can hear the East of the Rockies thing.
Where are you?
I am calling you from Canton, Ohio. My name is Paula.
Okay, Paula.
And it's a distinct pleasure to speak with both of you. James, earlier in the show, you were talking about the fact that we have not been hit by anything in how many thousands of years. Is there a distinct possibility that there has been intervention from other sources that have kept us from being hit a meteor or something else?
Extraterrestrial billiard players.
Right.
Yes.
Actually, there's some good data. A friend of mine from Turkey is a head of a group over there, and they have actual footage taken by an airline pilot of an object coming in, kind of like you would see almost in the Deep Impact movie. And all of a sudden, a laser beam comes out of nowhere and zaps this thing. There are three installations on Earth that we know of. There's one in Russia, there's one in Turkey, and I'm not sure where the other one is, but that have been identified as what are believed to be ancient earth-protecting automated sites, which can basically zap objects as they come in.
Man, every time I expect a big no from you, it turns out to be a yes. It blows me away.
So
there is evidence.
There is evidence that, yes, that someone has tried to protect this planet. The other issue is that the big ones that would come by and probably do the most damage, there's nothing available for those guys.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanney. Morning. Hello. Going once. Going twice. Gone. International line, you're on the air with James McCanney. Good morning.
Good morning, Art, and hi, James.
Hello.
Is it possible as a consideration to think of a nuclear weapon, possibly using ion propulsion for speed and distance, as a consideration of trying to protect the Earth from an incoming comet? I'd appreciate an answer. Thanks.
A nuclear explosion would have to be buried deep inside of an object out there to affect it, and in that case, will it in fact do something that will be beneficial? In other words, avert a dilemma. There's a lot of study that's been done on this. There's two camps. One is don't do it because you are going to have a difficult time controlling the pieces that come out of this. In any explosion, you get lots of pieces. The movie in Hollywood broke it into two pieces, but how many times is that going to happen?
Yeah, rarely, I guess. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanney. Good morning.
Art and James, I'd like to ask about the abandoned super collider project in Texas, whether that could be used as an underground safety site for NASA employees.
Well,
then why are they drilling?
I'm not sure. It's a big tunnel. I'm not sure how big the cavity itself is. A lot of times the chamber is relatively small where the particles are.
I try to get my mail every day. I don't have my invitation yet.
I don't either.
Oh, damn.
I understand there's a lot of ants there. One of the problems they had with that were the red ants eating the insulation on the wires.
Sounds like a bad place to hide out.
Maybe I don't want to go.
Unless you like red ants, which I've had a few encounters with those guys.
That'd be a hell of a way to go.
That would not be good.
No.
I'd
rather stay on top. All right, caller, that it?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McCanney. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Art, thank you so much for being one of the elite broadcasters who are brave enough to not screen your calls.
You're welcome.
Mr. James, what I'd like to ask is, should somebody at some point choose to cool off our planet by simply rotating our orbit just a minute little bit, how will that affect the moon, and what will that do to our tides?
Well, moving the planet is going to be a big job. But say that you did it. Your question is, how would it affect our tides? It could change. There are animals, life that is structured to those cycles in the sea and on land. So anything coupled to the moon would change, there again, we're all of the species seem to be adaptable. Whether it would be critical to some, I couldn't tell you that. But
as far as water levels go, would that nullify everything that we're trying to stop as far as global warming goes?
Well, the tides are separate. They're due to the gravitational influence of the moon and the sun, to a lesser degree, but anytime you start changing these things, you don't know of all of the side effects. One of the projects I had in my mega projects list was to take, when we have this increased runoff from Antarctica and Greenland, say, for example, to take that water and move it to desert areas. And so we'd have to develop ocean liners, or maybe big plastic vessels you would pull behind ocean liners. It turns out that in 1991, Asia sent an entourage of ships into the Great Lakes and took 152 million gallons of Lake Superior lake water over to Asia, and they finally got it stopped.
Wow.
But it just shows you that people on this planet are starting to do large ventures to move fresh water or to accommodate needs.
Unlike your comments on the, you've heard, of course, of the space elevator.
Yes.
Is it practical? Is it possible? Could we really do it?
Well, there's a little problem in that we have a very large capacitor between the ionosphere and down here on the planet Earth.
Ah.
And if you break that capacitor, you're going to be doing more than elevating. You're going to be driving that current, as with any capacitor. If you discharge a capacitor, it's going to flow along that line.
Ah.
And I don't think many people would be going up that elevator shaft.
You think it could be a fatal charge?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with James McKinney. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Perry from Sedalia, Missouri. And I've heard you reference a lot of times the legends and myths and old texts and stuff, and I'm kind of interested in Zachariah Sitchin. And I just never heard of this. It would interest me, intrigued me, whenever you mentioned about Venus taking the atmosphere from Mars. I'd never heard that Venus did it and got trapped. And it also makes me think of Major Ed Dame, something that he remote viewed one time, was something to the effect of some object bouncing off the atmosphere of Mars and stripping away its atmosphere.
Oh, yes, he said that, yes.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a little on that.
Okay.
So the reference specifically to Mars, the best reference comes from the Velikovsky books, the Worlds in Collision, Earth in Upheaval, and Ages in Chaos. And I don't know, that's probably in Worlds in Collision, but don't quote me on that. But he talks specifically about the Mars event and that Mars was a blue planet. It had a different orbit. Its orbit brought it closer to Earth prior to the event, and it had its orbit changed out to where it is now, according to the legends. But anyway, that's where you would find that information. That would be the best source.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McKinney. Good morning.
Hi. Besides wanting to say that I think George had a caller of a truck driver who had a truck driver friend who had delivered something to Texas, went into a tunnel and drove for miles and miles underground before he deposited his unknown load.
Maybe into this drilled-out tunnel, huh?
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking. And okay. and the primary reason I called, it may not be the most important, which I hope I have a chance to say last. Okay, I don't know whether this is a cuckoo idea, but...
there are no cuckoo ideas.
Yeah, okay. What about the idea that the bird flu is a way to thin out the population for the known coming disaster so that the people who are going to go into the bunkers will have less trouble getting in there?
Ah, all right. Well, we'll have to hold it there. And so what about that?
I don't know. There are many beliefs regarding the bird flu. A lot of people believe that the bird flu term is actually a cover for a man-made virus that might be released amongst the public. So,
we are conspiratorial son of a guns, aren't we? We really are. First time caller line. You're on with James McKinney. Hi.
Hi, this is Hal.
Yes.
My question is this. How long did it take nature to create oil?
Huh. And is it from old dinosaur carcasses?
Well, I don't care about that.
Well,
how
I
long
do.
Did it take?
I do. So how long?
The oil literally comes from the tail of comets. When we pass through these comet tails, it might take up to a month where we actually are passing through. The ancients talk about the hail of brimstone and naphtha, the burning naphtha coming in from outer space, and that occurred at the time of the Great Flood, which also came in from, the water came from outside the planet. But to answer your question, the hydrocarbons form relatively quickly in outer space, and this is a whole branch of chemistry. The water in the comet tail forms when hydrogen and oxygen molecules form the water molecule in outer space, and this is a whole branch of chemistry forming these, for example, hydrocarbon chains up to crude oil. in the chemistry of oil in general, you just have hydrocarbon chains. So methane and propane and all of these different things we break out of oil are smaller hydrocarbon chains. But the big ones, the crude oil, the black oil, is built up in outer space, and it doesn't really take long.
So then what? You're telling me then that dinosaurs were dust to dust? That's it? They're not 10W30 now?
That's right.
Is that really right?
That's correct. We have oil all over the planet. We have large pools under the ocean, and it came from outer space.
All right. And on that note, buddy, we're out of time.
Okay,
we have done it. What a blast it was, James. Thank you. And, of course, we'll have you back again, but it's been a total pleasure.
Well, Art, it's great being on your show always.
All right. You take care, my friend. That's it, folks, for now. That's really it.